Welcome to the podcast, Whiskey and a Map. Stories of adventure and expeditions as told by those who live them. I'm your host, Michael Reinhardt. It has been said that many adventures and expeditions start simply with a map and a glass of whiskey. A desire to go and see the world's wild places. You're invited to pull up a chair, pour yourself a glass of your favorite whiskey, and join us as we hear stories from another one of our friends just returned from the field. Our guest for this episode of Whiskey and a Map is Robert Anderson. Robert is a writer, a climber, paraglider, who goes to high places and brings the stories back to Earth. He led the ascent of a new route on Everest remote Kangshun face without oxygen or Sherpa support, which was described by Reinhold Messner as the best ascent of Everest in terms of style and pure adventure. He went on to summit the remaining seven summits solo. Anderson has also completed a number of new routes in the Arctic, as well as on Mount Vincent in Antarctica. The Rolex Ridge, which he made the first ascent solo, has yet to see a second ascent. Robert, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Very good this morning. Thank you.
Robert, you have quite an impressive expedition resume. But before I get to that, do you have a good drinking story for us?
Well, I might have a couple, but let's just stick with one. And I think a lot of my adventures have started or ended or been celebrated at the Explorers Club in New York, which is a fantastic old townhouse on the Upper East Side in New York with kind of explorers going back to including astronauts, Ed Hillary, famous polar explorers and everybody else. The atmosphere there is just so magical that oftentimes we'll go up to the top floor there, the trophy room, or even Ed Hillary's map room and lay out the maps and perhaps a good single malt. A friend of mine, Chris Hines, has a locker there, which makes it a little bit more convenient. And along with him, we've plotted quite a few good adventures around the world.
What a place to do your plotting. The map room must be one full of historical maps and one-of-a-kind maps. That's great. I can't imagine how great that would be, being there doing that.
Well, and it's much more, I think part of making adventures real is when you sit down with the maps. And it's very different, you know, ultimately nowadays we plot them on GPS and we look at satellite images and we put together profiles and we gather photographs in Google Earth from other expeditions perhaps. But there's nothing still like sitting down over, you know, a decent drink and a really good old slightly worn map, maybe with some annotations on the side of it to kind of give you a real feel for what you're doing. One of our actual adventures, you know, to the Arctic started with one of the flags that we got for the expedition had annotations on the side of it from one of the guys who'd been there before. So it's like a great place for inspiration and exploration.
Right. And connection to those explorers that went before you.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of explorers that went before you, in 1928, there was accomplished the first flight over the pole. Now, Later on, you recreated that, did you not?
We did. I met a friend actually through the Explorers Club. It was quite interesting. And he'd flown across Siberia. He'd purchased a couple of Antonov AN-2s, which are cloth-covered, if you can believe that, but they are cloth-covered, winged biplanes. But they're not small. It's not like the moths that you see in the U.S. These are big. They hold about 10, 12 people. We put about 5 people in them, plus a very large external or internal gas tank so we could have better range with them. And he'd flown those across Siberia, and on that he carried the flag. And along the way, he'd seen annotations in the flag from a man named Wilkins, who was an Australian explorer. And he'd actually taken that flight in 1928 across the pole. And it was little known because that was about the same time that Lindbergh flew the Atlantic. So his flight over the pole got more or less lost. He didn't probably fly exactly over the pole, but he flew all the way from Alaska and then across and eventually more or less crash landed in Svalbard over in Norway, the end of the journey. So we traced that in our two biplanes.
The question is why?
I think it was my friend Shane Lundgren. He was a very experienced pilot. He was the youngest kind of like 737 pilot in the world, I think at the age of 23, and had a real spirit of adventure. And he was like, once he'd gotten these biplanes across Russia, managed to get them into Alaska. I met him in New York, and when he showed me a picture, it was kind of one of those crumpled photographs that somebody holds up and says, look at this. And I was just captivated by these airplanes because they're just phenomenal kind of beasts. I think in the book that I wrote about it, you can see it here just at the top of us at the North Pole. And you think that's just a crazy thing. And it had a huge 9-cylinder engine in the front of it. And you literally sat pretty much on top of that. Flying it was like, I don't know, it almost sounded like the world's largest Harley Davidson. So it was a very visceral experience. There was no sound deadening or any of that. So if you were really out there, you know, we could open the windows if we wanted a breath of fresh air. And so it was really quite a good adventure.
How long did it take you to cross?
We tried in a year before, 97, and we didn't quite make it. We had a couple of planes, but one of the older ones, it blew oil all over the windscreen and kind of stuttered a bit, backfired, which when you're looking down at just endless plateaus of broken ice at the North Pole wasn't very reassuring. So we turned around and we went back the next year. And then it took us literally, it took us about 18 to 20 hours nonstop to fly all the way across. And one of the planes made it all the way to Svalbard and the other one had to stop at a military base in North Greenland and overnight there and refuel and then come across to Spitsbergen. So it was an adventure. And then eventually the pilot, he literally, after flying it across there, the whole trip took us about 7 or 8 days. We got over to Europe, flew it into Norway, and then they flew it back across the Atlantic. And it's now in the museum up at the Boeing Field up in Seattle, Washington, south of there. It actually sits under the wing of the world's first 747 to fly. So you've got this nice little tidy Antonov sitting underneath this immense 747 up there. People can see it there.
What was going through your mind? What were your thoughts as you were sitting in that plane crossing the Arctic?
I think some of them were pretty simple explorer thoughts. One, I was very glad I was in the plane and not on the ground. Two, I'm not what I would call an experienced pilot at all. I fly paragliders a lot, and I'm comfortable in the air in one of those. But in the Antonov, I wasn't really sure what was going on, so I was just glad to have some hugely experienced pilots, you know, bush pilots from Alaska like Ron Sheardown, and then, like I mentioned, Shane Lundgren was there, Ferdinand von Bombach. These kind of guys had flown, were very experienced going across this kind of terrain, so I trusted them. And then I was also there as kind of if we went down on the ice, I was nominally the survival expert who was hopefully going to get us home. So I got to like make sure I knew where the gun was in case the polar bears came out. So it was a real kind of mixed bag. But then, of course, it's daylight all the time. So the views simply out the windows were fantastic. And once we were in the air, the pilots soon got bored. So I got to fly an awful lot. It was fantastic. I could take over and sit up front and just fly along with this amazing airplane.
Well, how cool is that? And if I recall right from your book, those Russian planes are vintage 1947?
That's correct. They were pretty much kind of came out, and they're almost used as pickup trucks in Siberia because they couldn't really build roads due to the permafrost. So they used them very short takeoff and landing. At some point, we were flying across Alaska from Anchorage, and I was flying, and I was asking Shane, like, you know, how do we navigate? And he goes, Robert, just follow the road. Because we were only up at about 4,000 or 5,000 feet. We just followed the road. And after a while, we dipped down a bit. And I realized that we had a bit of a headwind and the cars were going faster than we were. So it was quite an interesting experience flying that thing and lumbering along in the sky.
And I could imagine it being cloth covered, that the temperature inside was not much different than the temperature outside.
Yeah, it was pretty cool out the back, but that was mostly filled up with this 400 or 500 gallon kind of extra fuel tank. And then, you know, a lot of times up front, once we got it going and got that engine heated up, it was pretty good. Like I said, we could open the windows and kind of air it out a bit. So it started out cold. And we got off, I think at the pole, it was about 17 below Fahrenheit at the North Pole. We never shut it down. So we just kept them running. We landed there and spent about 15, 20 minutes and took off again.
Quite a remarkable adventure. It sounds crazy. And I've heard some crazy stories going across in a 1947 biplane made in Russia. Robert, in your climbing career, you've achieved what climbers call first ascents and established new routes on some of the world's most difficult mountains. Now, to a mountaineer, what does that mean to be able to do a first ascent or create a new route up an established mountain?
I think the interest in new routes is always, it's kind of climbing stem from, you know, going way back. It was kind of about exploration and discovery. It was, where are we going and what can we do? It wasn't about somebody's been there, so I'll follow their route, and or nowadays follow the fixed ropes and turn on as much oxygen as possible. It was very much about finding a new way. So in a sense, it was more like artistry. It was like you had to be able to look at the mountain and read the rock and look at the ice and the snow and figure out where the avalanches were and when the best season was. So if anything, the planning and the preparation and getting ready for the ascent was much more important. And of course, if you were doing a route that somebody else had done, if you were a good climber and you thought, well, they've done it, so I can probably do it, at least you knew there was some kind of humanly way to get up it. Whereas sometimes when you look at routes, and particularly when we were looking at new routes on Everest, it might look like you could get up there, but maybe potentially it would be too dangerous or just too difficult or too hard to actually climb it in the style that you wanted to. So it could literally almost be impossible. So it was that unknown and that sense of uncertainty which really makes for a really good adventure and makes it ultimately a lot more rewarding as well.
There's almost an artistry and an art to reading the mountain and the rock.
Yeah, when you look at it, and I still, even out here in Thailand, there's some desert cliffs and, you know, that we that are in these certain dry areas. And they're not desert, obviously, because it's jungle here, but it's so dry on the south side that it feels like desert, like what we used to climb up in Dubai and UAE. So you look at them and you can pick roots and cracks and things, even though none of them have been done. And I can see ways up it and imagine myself getting up there and where it might work or where it might not, or what might fall out of the trees above you to stop you. So it's a real kind of a way of looking at mountains in a different way and then imagining yourself up there and how it might be to climb them.
I want to take you to South America. When you were first starting out your climbing career, was there a particular climb that had a significant impact on you?
I think I went down there with a group that I met. I'd spent a year at university in London as I studied literature and theater over there. And so I had a small group of friends, about five of us, that went down there. And we'd done a lot of hard climbs, both in the UK, also in the Alps. And we went down to a slightly more remote area with a mountain called Yerushanka. And we'd climbed a few, and then we went up to Solo, a peak. And at this point in our lives, we pretty much thought we were invincible. We, you know, we were 19, 20, 21 years old. We'd fallen off a few times, but in order to get up these new routes, a lot of times you had to have this huge self-confidence. So being young, bold, and perhaps in retrospect, a bit foolish, we went up to do a new route on a mountain called Yerushanka Chico. And we completed the route and we're headed down. And myself and a friend, we went down one way, just because I thought, well, if we fall off, the snow was terrible. If we fall off here, at least I'll only slide whatever. And the cliff that we'd come up, I didn't like the looks of. And one of my friends decided to climb down the cliff, and we suddenly heard a rock fall, and he fell probably 1,000 meters to his death. And I suddenly realized that this sense of invincibility could also change to one where you were obviously not invincible and things could immediately flip over. And people could die very suddenly. So it gave me an early realization that just how dangerous this game of alpinism is.
But you continued.
I continued. Actually, I took some time off. One of my friends had to go back for an inquest. And myself and a friend, we traveled around. And I went down and I thought, if I'm going to continue in this, I'm going to have to do something else. And I went down and soloed the tallest peak in Peru, which is about 22,000 feet high, which is the highest I'd ever been at the time, kind of did it in a day and a half, which both brought my confidence back, but it also gave me a sense of how well I performed at altitude, because I was able to just keep moving quite quickly, even though I'd gone up very fast in the mountains. So it kind of it brought me back to the fold again, and I realized how much I got out of it. That was better than, you know, what potentially might happen on the downside.
Do you think it gave you a deeper appreciation of climbing?
Yeah, and a deeper appreciation for the seriousness of it, you know, because I've carried that with me ever since. And I think when you're a climber over a certain period of time, particularly when you get to the Himalayas and places like that, you have over time quite a few friends that will die, either in the mountains or from other events, but mostly it seems in the mountains. And you have to kind of accept that pretty early on, that it's a very, very dangerous environment, and what you're gaining from it and what you're, particularly when you're climbing with teams, what you're doing together is more important than what potentially might kill you, actually.
Robert, you mentioned solo climbing. How is solo climbing different from traditional climbing with a team?
I think with a team, your relationship naturally is very much with yourself and with other members. And that's the most important factor, is like how well you are climbing, how well they are climbing, how you feel. And then, of course, very importantly, particularly on new routes, the decision-making is a joint and a shared one, whether you're going to go up and whether you're going to go down and what you think about the weather. So there's very much that's at the forefront. When you're soloing, it's very much the climber and the mountain, and that's it. So your relationship is 100% with the mountain. So it's much more dictated by how you feel, which you don't really have to think about because you know how you feel. And then your decision-making is completely on your own. It might be influenced by, well, if I was climbing with someone who is more conservative, would they have gone down by now? Or am I pushing it out too far? What am I doing here? But it's very much just a relationship direct with you. And I think part of that is the enjoyment factor goes up quite a bit, because you're very in tune with, particularly when you're on ice and mountains and snow, you're very in tune with exactly how you're attached to the face, and every crampon point becomes important, and how your tools are being placed in the ice or in the crevices in the rock, and how you're kind of climbing the mountain. It becomes very, very focused, and consequently the activity can be very, it's quite, people talk about the sense of flow, but you're 100% in the moment when you're there and you're doing it when it's difficult. I've never been lonely solo climbing. You've got too much to think about, too much to do, particularly as it gets harder.
Margin of safety has to be very small.
It is very, very small. And at the same point, it kind of drives you to say, you know, I have to do this perfectly, or I'm not going to be doing it for too long. So you have to have that ability to decide to go up, decide to go down, and to make sure that every move you make and every, you know, tool placement that you use is absolutely perfect at the time.
Now, you have climbed literally around the world. I mean, the Himalayas, all the big mountains, South America, North America. Is there a particular area or a particular climb that really stands out to you, that means the most to you?
Well, I think the one that certainly people know about the most is when we did the new route on Everest in the Kangshung face. But I moved on after that and spent quite a bit of time in Antarctica. And I think I really fell in love with that environment. I've been able to get down there 7 or 8 times now. And when I've been there, it's been a whole range of things. I've been able to solo climb. I've been able to climb with teams. I've worked with Antarctic Logistics as a guide. So all those experiences have given me a whole range of things that I've been able to do down there. And I just love being down on the continent, sharing time with the teams and the people that I both meet and sometimes come along with me, and then the people that I'm guiding when I'm climbing and working with ALE down there.
How is Antarctica different in climbing style and techniques than anywhere else?
I think the thing that is the most, the thing that really becomes evident is it's very remote. It's like on the way down there, originally it was a DC-6, then they transitioned to Ilyushins, or big Russian 4-engine jet. Now they're flying, I think, Boeing 757, so it's a little bit more sedate almost. And so just going down there, you fly over the Arctic and the sun comes up if you take off at night, and then it doesn't go down until you leave. So you're in a completely daylight until you leave. So it's like one long day the whole time you're there. And then when you fly out to the mountain, again, you get on a little ski plane and you fly out to the mountain or fly off to the coast and start to ski towards the South Pole. And it's, you feel very, very much alone. When that plane takes off again, you're like, oh my gosh, I'm in the middle of absolute nowhere and there's nothing's going to get me out of here. So I better make sure and do everything properly. And then I think initially too, it's sometimes both warmer in the day than you might expect, but when the shade comes, it's frighteningly cold, and you realize there's a reason why people aren't able to live there and sustain life like for very long, or they have to have huge amounts of support to hold out down there in the cold. So it's kind of all those extremes of life which kind of combine to create a really unique experience, really enjoyable activities down there.
And as part of your climbing down there, did you achieve one of these first ascents?
I did. I was very fortunate. I went down there the first time, and we partnered with Conrad Anker and Jay Smith, and I went with my photographer, Joe Blackburn. And I went down to solo, and we were able to, I was able to climb a couple of entirely new routes, which consequently have never been repeated. The logistics down there have changed a bit, and the snow conditions have changed. So maybe they won't be, who knows. But I walked in there and up the glacier, and I looked off to this big face that I saw, and I wanted to try something easier to start with, but there was an incredible snaking line. It was about 2,000 meters that went directly up this face and then got very narrow and skinny at the top and just turned to ice. But it was just too tempting to not try, so I went up and had a look at it and came down and rested a day, and then I went back up and did the whole thing. And I was probably out for about 30 hours, but it never gets dark, so as long as you don't keel over, you're okay. So I soloed that route called the Sunshine Face, and then I came down and we did a couple of first ascents on new peaks and regrouped with Conrad and his team, camped out with them, and then I came down, and then we just had a few days before we left, and I'd seen another big ridge, which had been my original objective, and it was quite a lot larger, and I ended up doing the first ascent of the Rolex Ridge, which I did over, I think, 12 hours to summit. It was over 3,000 meters of vertical and then came down. So it was kind of a 20-hour round trip on that. So two phenomenal and fun solo ascents down there. And then I was able to go back 10 years later and climb with my two friends I mentioned earlier, Chris Heinz and Intasar Haider, up to the summit on another new route. So we had a lot of activity on that face. I think at one time I was the person who'd done more new routes in Antarctica than anyone had done before.
To do a new route like that, especially in such a remote area, I believe you were telling me in another conversation we had that there was one particular route that you were looking at. You could see fairly good line, and then there was a spot up there that you weren't quite sure, but you went anyways. Do you recall that?
Yes, I do. Yeah, that was on the Sunshine Face, and it got narrower and narrower, this couloir, and up at the top, it didn't quite connect. And I almost knew before I got there that I was probably going to have some challenges up there. But luckily, when I got up there, I'd been training a lot. I'd done a lot of peaks that year. I'd done, I think, 5 of the 7 summits, and I'd done a couple of quite hard routes on them. And it was literally, you're up a couple thousand meters off the kind of glacier below, and probably just 500 meters down below the summit. So up at a relatively high elevation. And you literally had to front point for probably 50, 60 meters up a very thin ice runnel and then switch over through some kind of mixed rock, which is always the trickiest part up there, I find, on those things. And then I got over, and then it just rolled off into the summit plateau. So it was a very kind of thin, really nice tiptoey section on front points, which was really, in retrospect, quite enjoyable. But at the time, I knew I probably wasn't going to be able to reverse that. And I ended up going back down. Luckily, Conrad and Jay and their team had gone up another way around on a glacier, and I was able to descend that way, which is a whole lot easier than having to go back down that face again, which I wouldn't want to have done.
For folks who are listening that are non-climbers, what does it mean to front point?
Well, you have your crampons on. You got 12 points, well, maybe 14 these days, on each foot. And two of the points stick out over your toes. So you have your boot there, and then you have the toes. And then you got 2 points right there. And that's all that goes in the ice. So you're literally standing on those, and the rest of your boot, literally your entire sole of your foot, is just hanging out a bit. So it's a little precarious, but you got 4 points there between the two of them, and you got 2 ice axes. So it's it's relatively solid. The technology today is so good that if you've got two or three good points of contact, you're fine.
Well, you also have about 1,000 meters of air underneath your heels.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. You don't really, after the first 50 meters, it doesn't really matter. So if you slip or fall, it's all the same. And it becomes quite inspiring and beautiful when you're up that far. When you're up there and you're alone and you're in control, it's absolutely perfect. You know, it's gorgeous. You're pretty much, for a short period of time, a perfect human being. You're in control. You're in charge. You're moving up the mountain. Everything is fine. Or it's not. It's just there's a very, very big line between the two experiences, obviously.
When you reach the summit after making that crossing over the ice and then up that rocky bit, take us to the top there with you. If we were up there with you on that peak, what would we see?
It's probably one of the most stunning, certainly, I think, if not the most stunning of the seven summits, because in all directions, it's just white and ice and a few rocks, but it's all multiple shades of white and colors as the sun goes around. Because even though the sun goes around and it's always up, it varies in how high it is above the horizon. So the light and the colors change all the time. But you do literally feel like you could see forever. You can look straight south down towards the South Pole. You can look out over towards the sea, which actually isn't that far away, but it's covered over by ice. And certainly it's a very easy place. I did a 360-degree video last time I was up there guiding, and it was just a quick spin around in about 60 seconds of me and my team on top. And then my fingers were frozen pretty much, so I turned it off. But it really is quite spectacular. It's just a phenomenal experience to be up on the top of Mount Vincent.
Well, and that route that you took is technically challenging. You have the climate. You've got everything that Antarctica throws at you, and still made it. It's quite an accomplishment.
It was rewarding, but it was also just personally very satisfactory. It's satisfying. It was just a fantastic climb to do. It's probably a couple of the best and the funnest climbs that I've done. They were so pure and simple. They were done at a time when I was lucky to get permission to solo. It's very difficult to do that at all now. Mostly the people just go down, 99% probably go down and do the regular route and go up and down that. So it's great to get out to those other sides of the mountain. Like I said, I've been able to work with Adventure Antarctic Logistics, and they've given me permission to go out and try some other new routes and ski some different places and explore. So I've had a very good relationship over the years with kind of getting permission to go into some more adventurous areas down there.
As you stood atop that peak, having soloed it, is there a different feeling of accomplishment as opposed to coming up with a team?
I almost enjoyed it more returning with the team because you have people to share it with. When I was up there on my own, I was very aware. I was quite tired because I've been climbing for a long time. I was very aware of how challenging it was going to be to get down. And as much as there's not a lot of crevasses in Antarctica on Vincent, and they're what I'd call well-behaved crevasses, as opposed to like the Denali crevasses, which are not well-behaved. They're everywhere and you don't see them, and they're absolutely immense and frightening. The Antarctica crevasses are pretty much straight down and the edges are cut. So you can solo pretty comfortably down there as long as you have skis on. But it was that whole kind of fear of getting down safely and going back down all the way down the face. And there was a few sections when I did the Rolex Ridge where actually it was harder almost low down than it was high up on the ridge itself. And then getting back down to the glacier, I knew it after front point again, back down off of a ridge to get down to the glacier and back to my camp there. So there's a certain amount of, I'm here at the top, but it's only halfway really. I need to get off this safely.
Yeah. The mountaineer's breed is that if you're at the top, it's only halfway. You still need to make it down. Climb's not finished until you're back at base camp. In fact, I suppose most deaths on the mountain are on the way down.
Yeah, I think the peaks that have most of the statistics on it are like on Everest, and I think it's probably 50% or more that happen on the way down. I think part of it is you relax, and it's also technically quite difficult to get down. So sometimes, and you can be tired, so it's easier to slip off then.
What is the strangest thing you've ever experienced out there on your expeditions?
I think in Antarctica, I was kind of up probably 5 or 6 hours in on my ascent of the Rolex Ridge. And I looked out to the side and the sun was coming around. And I'm not sure how they really form, but there's ice crystals and they fall as snow, obviously. And then the wind carves and cuts them, but very gently. And so you get almost these huge snowflakes that also almost seem to be not as big as your hand. And they're all interlocked together. And so you get the sun, kind of the equivalent of a sunrise or a sunset, because it's lower, even though it never sets. And the orange color kind of coming through off the horizon and then reflecting against the ice crystals. And it was just absolutely gorgeous. And I was fortunate because I was able to take a picture of that, which actually came out relatively close to what it was like. So it didn't capture it all, but it was literally like climbing through, you know, just this kind of fairy tale, you know, 6-inch deep kind of ice crystals just kind of flowing up around me. And then this kind of reflection off into the horizon far, far away. So it was very different. I wouldn't say it was necessarily strange, but it was amazingly interesting phenomenon, just a great place to be.
Oh, very cool. Tell us about some of your closest calls out there. Situations where, you know, it was a little dicey whether you're going to make it back.
I think I'll probably have to move to Everest for that one, because in Antarctica, like I said, the soloing is so dangerous and it's so remote that if anything, my level of comfort is I climb conservatively. So I don't want to get in trouble there, because I think if you get close to getting in trouble, the ability to slip over and not come back is pretty high. So you have to be super careful about what you're doing. So the last book I wrote is called Nine Lives, and it's about 9 expeditions to Everest. And each chapter is more about just an encapsulation, just a short bit of when there was either the most life-threatening or life-defining moment. And when we were on the Kangshung face of Everest, I probably lived through 9 lives right there, actually. We had a lot of danger. We had avalanches coming down. We had rock fall. None of us ever fell off, because you just don't do that on big mountains like that. But I was in a crevasse with Ed Webster, who sadly just passed away. And we were down there and he was out in the lead going across. We kind of figured out we were going to weave our way through this thing. And when he hit the side of the wall, probably 20, 30 meters above us, was this huge ice ceiling across the top of the crevasse. It was probably 10 meters wide or so. And it fell in. The reverberation of it hitting the ice at the bottom of the crevasse made it fall in at the top. And I was belaying, and I was kind of out of the way, but I just heard this thing and saw it cut loose. And I knew Ed was right there, and I thought he was dead, and I covered myself up. And then I was kind of still sitting there as the dust cleared, thinking I would just have a rope going over there to Ed. And I'm like, Ed, Ed. And he was like, Robert, I'm right here. And he was literally standing right next to me. And somehow he'd managed to sense that thing was falling out of the sky and leapt across between the time it was on top and in the bottom, which seems impossible, and still seems impossible to this day. But that was certainly pretty close. And that was one that was absolutely terrifying. And then a second instance is when we were on the way down this huge crevasse, which we'd bridged, which became very famous. And my picture ran in the cover of the National Geographic Adventure of it, of Ed doing this phenomenal climb up this wall. When we came down, it had obviously stretched. The crevasse was just attaching a smaller buttress to the main buttress of the mountain, and it obviously widened, and the rope was stretched like a piano wire. And if that would have snapped, we were so tired, we wouldn't have gotten down. I don't think we'd been able to reverse the whole crevasse. So we were just lucky. I think we were fortunate enough to meet Reinhold Messner at the end of the climb in Lhasa, and we were telling him the story. We were stuck there while we waited for planes for 3 days, and he kind of commented along the way. He goes, yeah, guys, I've been lucky too sometimes. I can understand. You just don't want to do that too often. We said, no, we don't.
No, you don't. These solo climbs, new routes, close calls over the years, how do you think it's changed you?
I think it builds a certain level of self-confidence and an appreciation for things. And you realize, particularly after we did the new route on Everest, that the days after that they were really a gift. You know, we'd managed to survive that thing, and we were lucky. And we all went on to climb a lot more routes and a lot more things across the team. The other thing was there's always been, people have had animosity, or certainly when you do climbs that are famous, at least in the climbing world, there can be a lot of team strife and things. And that's something that we never had across the four of us that were on the team. Stephen Venables, who became the first British climber to summit without oxygen, myself, Ed Webster, and Paul Tier, we've always had an amazingly close relationship, along with our Dr. Miriam Zeman. We were fortunate to have Norbu Tenzing, the son of Tenzing Norgay, along with us. I literally had an email from him yesterday because I'm organizing another adventure in Nepal next year. And the team that I put together, I was just very fortunate with. They were amazing individuals. We've always stayed close. We've always shared experiences. We've edited each other's books. And so that's been amazingly rewarding over time, is the people that I've climbed with. So it's
team selection is something that can make or break any expedition. How do you think you were so successful in putting together such a good cohesive team?
I was fortunate when I first started climbing, as I grew up in Colorado. So I climbed with a lot of very talented climbers when I was young. David Brashears was there. In El Dorado, who went on to direct the IMAX movie and who I've met and, you know, seen since and kept in touch with. Pete Athens was around. There were a lot of super talented people there. And so you learn what the characteristics were of people who were not only climbers, but people who climbed new routes. And then the balance of it, which might be a bit antithetical, but at the time when I put together the Everest team, I just started a new company in New Zealand. I worked for a very large and successful advertising agency, and I just started my own company. And we grew very quickly, and I had to pick a lot of people. And as much as the characteristics for choosing creative people who can write ads or design websites or whatever it might be, shoot TV commercials, is quite different, the characteristics of creativity, of spontaneity, of curiosity, of this love of adventure, and a sense of, you know, being able to persevere through difficult situations is not entirely different. So a lot of that business experience carried over. And part of the success, too, is I was able to find a group of sponsors then. So it was a very, very well-funded expedition. And it's much easier to run a successful climb if you're not always concerned about your bank balance, that you can hire the yaks you need, get the porters, have the right gear, spend the amount of time you need on the mountain, have great food. And that was based on my advertising experience. It had really nothing to do with my climbing ability. And that helped kind of create and build a solid team who had a really good chance on a rather large mountain.
Well, and a quite difficult new route. The route itself, and maybe you could explain for us the difficulty of that new route.
For people who climb in the Alps, Stephen Venables, who'd done the Eiger, said the first part was as hard as the Eiger, if not a bit harder. And that was only kind of the first day of climbing, really. It took us 7 days to put the rope in on it because it was about 1,000 meters. Then we had to go through that crevasse. That took Ed Webster and I 4 days, 3 days of climbing and a day up and a day down. That's 5 days. And altitude, we can always blame the mathematical calculations on altitude. And so it was, it was difficult to put all those things together at one in one way, you know. I think I lost my train of thought there. You better edit that part, Michael.
Well, and I could see thinking back to that route, but I've seen pictures of it. It's a new route up Everest that you were putting up. It looks extraordinarily difficult, and I was hoping that you could give the folks a better idea just the difficulty you had and the challenges you had putting up that route.
We were very lucky in that even though I only had a few pictures and I'd had a rough idea where I wanted the route to go, with starting out, having some good hard climbing, having some fun, not just slogging through the snow, then reaching a point up high where we could get to the top. And there had been only one route done by the Americans, and they'd used winches, and they'd been back over a couple of years, and they'd had a reconnaissance. It just wasn't the style I wanted to use. So I saw this side of the face that went up a buttress and then went up easier snow slopes and reached the South Col. And I thought from the South Col to the top, I was fortunate I lived in New Zealand, so I could talk to Ed Hillary about the route, which is quite amazing to be able to describe how to get to the summit of Everest by Ed Hillary. And So I thought we can do this amazing hard climbing and that'll be a lot of fun and make it more interesting. The challenge was that there were also a lot of avalanches, and I was very fortunate in that we managed to find a route just enough off the side. So as much as we got hit a few times, we were on the ropes and we didn't get swept away. But it was very borderline. And I think there was a point about 3 or 4 days in when we all realized this route could very easily kill us because there were avalanches. It was steep climbing. The rock was beautiful, but not particularly solid. But it was a new route on Everest, and we were willing to do that. But lead after lead, you know, with the climbing in the crevasse that Ed did with Stephen Venables able to go out, we just had 100-meter ropes, 9-mil ropes. Because I'm like, we can't go out and climb on climbing ropes and then fixing ropes. It's just too slow. We'll just climb on fixed ropes. And, of course, they have no stretch if you fall off. So you're basically going to rip all your anchors. But that's what we climbed on because it was faster. So we pushed the boat out in a whole bunch of ways that you wouldn't normally do. But fortunately, across the team that I had, the guys were all such phenomenal climbers that we could kind of look up and say, yeah, off you go. And we climbed in kind of two teams of two, Paul and I, and then Stephen and Ed. And then we'd switch out depending on, you know, what kind of the conditions were and who we thought could best get us up the mountain. But it was a very, very hard climb. It was interesting. I talked to David Brashears afterwards because he went back. David Brashears, Alex Lowe, Steve Swenson, and Sandy Pittman went back shortly after we did it. And David, I talked to him beforehand and gave him as much information as I could. And afterwards, he came back and he goes, oh, Robert, that route is hard. And to hear that from David Brashears, who was a phenomenally talented climber, I was like, I was trying to tell you that, David. It's not just kind of hard. It's like hard pitch after pitch after pitch, like 35 or 40 pitches. You know, so.
And you were successful?
Yeah, and we were successful. We were fortunate with getting across the crevasse and then, you know, getting up to kind of 7,300 meters that our first real big push up high. And then we went back and got up to the South Col. Every member of the team made the South Col, so really completed the route. And then three of us went on up as far as the South Summit. Stephen Venables was very fast, fit, healthy that day and carried on alone to the summit. So, yeah, it was fantastic. And then we took another 4 days, absolute kind of epic descent, which just about killed us off, but managed to get back down again.
Yeah, got to get back down. There have to be a lot of lessons learned over these years and the experiences that you had. Any particular lessons that stick with you that you can share with us?
I think one of them is, and I think it kind of goes across other climbers who are doing big climbs, is the ability to prioritize what you want to do and get rid of the non-essential items. You know, you can come up with about 50 things to do every day, and about 3 of them are important. And I think it's so true now, not to jump into the other side of my life, but I do lectures and corporate motivational things. And I think so much digitally now is the immediate overwhelms the important. And people, oh my, I must do this, you know, immediately because I just got this email or I got this text or somebody's online and I have to, you know, respond to it. But it's not really important. You know, if you're looking at a big picture, and the good thing about climbing is you have simple goals. Okay, I want to climb Everest. I want to do this. I want to do that. So one of the things is the ability to prioritize and to say to yourself, this is important. This is what I want to do. What do I need to do to accomplish this? And do that and do it first without fail. So you actually get it done and could do it. So it's that. And then I think the other thing is simple, bloody-minded perseverance. You know, once you decide to do something, keep at it. And I think I found this on all the new routes that I've done in particular. You got to be adaptable. You know, if you're an artist and the color blue doesn't work or you run out, you go with a tangerine colored or whatever and change the whole look and feel of the thing. And certainly, you know, particularly on a really big route like the Kangshung Face, if you've got 3,500-4,000 meters of climbing to do, you have to adapt. If you're going up one way and it blanks out, you have to think of some other way to get around it or how you're going to do it. So be adaptable. So it's kind of that, you know, the importance of what you're doing and prioritizing that, figuring out, you know, what you can get rid of to get up to the top and then prioritizing things to make it all happen.
Persevere, but be flexible.
Yeah. Perseverance with flexibility. That sums it up.
Yeah. Can't you imagine how all of us could be so much more effective than we do if we had that focus that you had climbing that new route in Antarctica. Just that laser-like focus of making sure that those 2 points go in correctly, and 1 foot, 2 points go correctly, and the other foot, keep going.
Yeah, I think that's part of the beauty of it, is the simplicity of solo climbing. And solo climbing is perceived as being very dangerous, but there's certain elements of it. Normally you can climb quicker, which particularly if in an alpine area, being fast is a very, good idea. Pete Athens told me the first time we went to the Himalayas, he said, there's two kind of climbers here, Robert, the quick and the dead. I'm like, oh, that's simple. And when you're soloing, it's fast. And I soloed a lot when I was young in El Dorado Springs in Colorado. And I was amazed that climbs that I originally started out that would be quite difficult, that you'd take all day to do, sometimes almost getting stuck on the things. When I went back and I felt confident enough and comfortable enough to solo them, you could get up these routes that took you 7 hours and 45 minutes. It was like, wow. You had a chalk bag and a pair of rock shoes on, and you went for it. Of course, if you fell off, you died. But the speed with which you could ascend these routes was amazing.
What's next for you? You said you're organizing another expedition to the Himalayas?
I'm working on a couple of trips to the Himalayas next year, and just looking at those now. I just got an email this morning, actually, from somebody, so it's still ticking over. And that one's still kind of a quiet one, but a big one. It'll be a lot of fun. I've taken a real interest in the 7,000-meter peaks. The 8,000-meter peaks have become almost too busy, certainly the regular routes. I guided a 7,000-meter peak this fall, Himlong Himal, with a group from Jagat Globe, and we were very successful, had a fantastic time. We had, once it quit raining for a week, we had fantastic weather, climbed up through three camps and onto the summit. With 10 of us, so it was just a phenomenal experience. And there wasn't the ego and the kind of angst and all those things. We actually used our ice axes. The last time I climbed Everest, when I guided it in 2010, I didn't take my ice axe off my pack. And when I got back down again, I realized that was a bit telling, that it's become something else. There's a whole division now in climbing where there were marathons and people started doing those 1,000 years ago or so. 100 years ago. Then there's triathlons. And now kind of with what people are doing in the Himalayas, they're climathons. They're not really related to climbing in the historical sense. They're simply competitions to set records on routes that are done. And basically you make the mountain as easy as you can make it. You go the fastest route, you go the easiest way, you go at a time when hopefully most of the fixed ropes are in, and you pick the best season. And you climb as fast and hard as you can. So it's a climathon. It's not a climb, as you might say. So
it's interesting you say that. I was interviewing Brent Bishop. He's a climber out of Washington. And he was opining and reflecting on the same thing, that it's difficult on those big mountains to do what he calls climbing style.
Yeah.
So now he seeks out peaks. It sounds like a lot like what you're doing, mm-hmm. that are not now tourist places, so to speak, but where you can still climb in style, still have that adventure, the raw relationship with the mountain, if that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. It's very similar. And I've met Brent as well. I'd say we share a very similar philosophy. And I knew his father, Barry, as well. I met him at the National Geographic when we were putting together our early routes and stuff. So it's very much that sense of adventure. And just even in the last climb that we did, we walked up to an area quite remote on the Tibet border, and there would be days on the trail when we wouldn't see anybody. There'd be a one or two porters, and there'd be our mules like somewhere. You didn't know where they were, but it was just us. It was very remote, and it was just so nice. It was even less remote than the Kumbu when I first walked up there in 1985. So it was beautiful, and as much as it was like, oh, we're all alone, it's kind of cool up here, it just has a different atmosphere. You have a much closer sense of the mountains. You have blue sheep wandering along the trail above you. You hope to see a snow leopard always. So it's an amazing experience. It's more about you and just the small team in nature, as opposed to, fighting over, service at the tea houses.
Do you have your... Do you run your own guiding company?
I guide privately. If I have, a few groups, fortunately, that just kind of like to go out and climb mountains with me. They almost take my recommendations. It's pretty good. We've been to Greenland. We've been to Morocco. We've been to Antarctica. And then occasionally we do something like go climb Mont Blanc just for fun. So kind of a trip of year, but that's I do those privately. And then I work with Jagged Globe for the bigger peaks in Nepal. And I guide, you know, I've guided Everest with them, Makalu, Choyoyu, Shishipangma, a lot of the big 8,000 meter peaks, and also in Antarctica. So we have a very good relationship with them, and they tend to bring clients who are strong, don't whimper, moan, complain, compare. So don't mind a pint of beer, like a good cup of tea. Get on very well with all those people. And then I also guide kind of the remote treks, and that I do sometimes in Nepal. And they also go out. I did one in Pakistan with them up to K2 base camp called the Mountain Company, which is also based in the UK. So high mountains, good long walks and scenic areas I want to visit. But I'm fortunate in that I can kind of pick and choose where I want to go and what I want to do. And if I come up with something I want to do on my own, I can do that as well. I'm going off to, my wife is a very keen climber and wants to go do Gashabram 2 in the Pakistan next summer. So we're headed in that direction. So a lot of different adventures.
Great lifestyle. For folks who may want to follow you or even get in touch with you to go out with you, how would they do that?
They can find me. My father's name is Danish/Norwegian, Mads, M-A-D-S. So as much as the Robert Anderson is very common, Robert Mads Anderson, M-A-D-S, you'll find more references than I care to think about on a Google search for that. That can take you to Amazon. So I've got 16 different editions of my four books out there now. And then I write a blog, which is during every season and things that tends to peak a bit, but I cover off a whole range of things from how to not get frostbite to how Vincent is different from Mount Everest to the people doing the climathons these days. And that's at Explore 7 Summits. The 7's a number. And yeah, my latest book is out in English and also available digitally. And it's also just been released in France as of last fall. The French did an edition. Good excuse to go up to Chamonix. If you're going to have a book launched in France, you got to go to the launch. And do quite a lot. I do a lot of paragliding as well. So it saves your knees on the way down. So I climb up and fly off as much as I can these days.
What is the title of your latest book?
It's Nine Lives. I do happen to have a copy here. I can just show it. There you go. Nine Lives. The original edition was done in New Zealand. And illustration by a New Zealand illustrator, Ross Murray, did an amazing job on it. It's kind of me with, it's actually kind of going up the face, just right up there by the Hillary Step with Choyoyu and Shishipangma in the background. The French one, actually, I really like. I think you did a brilliant job of that.
Nice. Well, I'll put links to each of those books.
Okay. Thanks.
Any final thoughts for folks out there about living a life like you do of adventure and exploration?
I think I was fortunate that very early on, I liked writing. Probably by the time I was 15, I published my first article when I was 18 or 19. And I did a degree in writing. And I went from there into marketing, into advertising. And I got a job at a fantastic advertising agency, Ogilvy, and worked all throughout the South Pacific and Asia. And just a phenomenal training ground for not only creative, but management, starting offices, building offices, selling offices, doing all those things. So I worked in a career that allowed me the flexibility to get in and out of the industry quite frequently. It was pretty volatile and you had to know when to move and when not to move. So if you're going to get a balance, you got to find something that allows you to balance. And luckily that stemmed from my writing. And then when it comes to climbing, is pick the climbs that are important. You know, there's always a whole range of climbs that can be done in mountains. There's a million places out there. And pick the ones that are important to you and not necessarily the ones that say, oh, I can do this. I can do it fast. I can set a record. If you want to do that, you probably might as well go do a triathlon. I do those as well. I love triathlons. They're fantastic, but it's certainly not climbing. So do the peaks where you enjoy and pick the right team. You know, that team is so essential as to who you're climbing with because that makes all the difference. And if you can't find anybody to climb with, go solo it, because that's always a lot of fun.
Thank you for joining us. We'll see you down the road when we get together again, share a glass of whiskey, and hear more stories of adventure as told by those who live them. Until then, check us out at michaeljreinhart.com, where you'll find more of my work as an adventure photojournalist. Photos, videos, and articles of interesting people, mysterious places, and exotic cultures from the wild places of the world.